these slides, and you will see why they are obvious, okay? Perhaps this one. No, I mean, I just want to reemphasize what probably Luis has already told you many times, that in about 2005, 2006, there were three pieces of work. Two of them became simultaneous, okay, that allows to do binary black hole simulations like the ones that I'm showing there. You have the two black holes, those bright dots, and the contrast is not good, but anyway, you get the point. And one of the first one was Pretorius, a single person effort, okay? And he was the first one to do one orbit, merger, and compute the radiation. Here's a snapshot of that. And then later on, it was about, if I remember correctly, it was October or November of 2005 in a conference organized by Centrella and Goddard Space Flight Center, in which these two groups, the group there and the group at that time in Austin, and Austin in Brownsville, came up with a solution to the, or at least to a prescription to solve the binary black hole problem, okay, that allows to do simulations of, again, of merger and compute. And since then, I mean, pretty much now it's business as usual. Right? You know, they say that you do simulations, and unless you do something really stupid, it's very difficult to crash the codes that we have to merge black holes in situations that are not too crazy. For instance, you know, comparable massive black hole, spins that are not too large, and so forth. Okay? So, of course, then that means that we're now, okay, driven by LIGO, Virgo, and other partners. And as you probably have already heard before, is because the data that these instruments collect is dominated by noise. So this is just a cartoon that tries to emphasize the challenge of noise plus a signal barrier there, that we need this type of information. This is just a profile, a waveform, of how the gravitational waveforms will look like when they arrive in these detectors. And without this, the job of the data analysis people will be a little much more difficult. So they need to have this to be able to see what to, be able to get an idea what to expect. Now, there are two challenges here. One of them is detection, and the other one is characterization. Detecting is to say, okay, the signal is there. For that one, you don't need a precise knowledge of this. I think with just getting a rough idea, you will be able to get it. But it's when you want to inform people that the signal is coming from two black holes of masses 10, solar mass 15, and spins of that magnitude, in which the accuracy could be a main factor on that. And so that's why it's very important that the people or the groups involved in doing this type of simulation not only hopefully work together to cover as much of the parameter space, but also be able to get working together with data analysis people to identify what is the accuracy needed, okay? So, but before I talk a little bit more about that, I just want to emphasize that what we do today, I mean, the people involved, like Luis and others in this type of work, we have to first, of course, to try to ensure that the results are right. There are roughly two avenues that you can do that. It's one of them is to do self-consistent checks within your own effort, okay? This is a clean problem in the sense that, you know, the equations are there. There is no physics that needs to be added. Use Einstein equations, provided the good initial conditions, you are all set. Okay? That's why you can talk about doing numerical convergence and it makes sense in that sense. It's not like in supernova. There is a physics that we still don't understand, or in galaxy formation that you have to put things like feedback and cooling and things like that, in for which it gets a little bit dirty. Here, at this point, it's still a clean problem in which you can be sure that your solution is a solution to the Einstein equations. So you can do it internally. The other one is that you can compare codes, and that is another way that we do it, especially now that there are basically two flavors on that. There is people who use this harmonic formulation and pseudo-spectral methods like the guys in CETA, Cornell, and Caltech, or like us, that we use what is called this BSSM formulation that is in finite difference and so on. And it's important to make attempts to compare one or the other. That's not the first time you do it. You know, cosmic string evolution comes. I remember when I was a graduate student that there were two codes doing that, and it was important to compare them and so forth. Probably they still do the same. cosmology simulations that should be doing the same thing, and supernova as well. So now, beyond these numerical relativity templates, there are two general areas in which you can apply or use those results. One of them is you can do comparisons with post-Newtonian. For instance, here you have that this dashed green line is the result from post-Newtonian. Okay? You can find an overlap and construct a longer waveform. Here you can do the overlap a little longer and to see what the match between post-Newtonian and numerical relativity is, to validate in the regime where post-Newtonian is valid, to validate the numerical results. That could be one way of doing it. Okay, you go to large separation in which both the post-Newtonian result and the numerical should give the same answer, and you use that for that. Or what you can do is to try to see where post-Newtonian breaks down. For instance, here it's clear that the two functions are divergent. There is a phase error and amplitude error, so you can also use this type of comparison to make a statement about when the post-Newtonian approximation breaks down. And all of that, you know, you can work in these collaborations that we all involved to some extent. Numerical relativity, analytical relativity, that is aim at doing this type of matching to help construct parametrized waveforms from numerical relativity information, or these other type of collaborations like Ninjang, which you interact with data analysis people to be able to help in the observational effort. Okay. Now, one more thing before I go into what I want to talk is that also the pioneer work or the breakthroughs in numerical relativity opened the door to do astrophysics. And the first one that created great excitement was the computation of the gravitational recoil or kicks. Okay? If you have an isotropy radiation of momentum, you get that the system at the end, okay, it will not aperture out, so you will have a recoil, okay, or a kick when the black holes merge. And there had been the early calculations, for instance, this is one that we did in Penn State, in which you have the recoil due to anisotropies triggered by spin alignments. You get up to 200 kilometers per second. Sperhacke and Campanelli et al., they compute what is called super kicks all the way to 2,400 kilometers per second. And that has so many implications, not only for the growth of black holes or the dynamics of galaxy mergers and so forth, that it created a great interest on that. And here is a piece of work that is related to electromagnetic observations that you see when you have the kick of the black hole affects the disk around it. And there are many other things. Now, these kicks are just too large, okay, to explain the presence of supermassive black holes at the galactic cores. But there are ways around. The most recent one by Sperhacke, Bertie, and Kasdan was, and I think he gave a talk here yesterday, the day before yesterday or something like that, right? I don't know if he was on that or he was on the spin alignments, but anyway, it was on spin alignments, and I think with that one, what they found is that the configuration that favors these super kicks is not likely to occur, or is in the parameter space is a small one. So that means that it's not a typical situation. A more typical situation will be one in which you have just a few, you know, about tens or at the most 100 kilometers per second. So I think it is safe to think that you don't have all these supermassive black holes kicked out of the galactic centers. Okay, so here, what I want to talk today is about supermassive black hole mergers, okay? And we have, as I mentioned before, that galaxies merge, okay? Very often they will have at their cores, they will have supermassive black holes, so it's a natural consequence that as the galaxies merge, you will have black holes merging, okay? This is one prime candidate of this situation in which it's expected that these two nuclei here, bright spot there, there are black holes there that are hopefully in the process of merging. Okay, however, the challenge to explain that is the following. Okay, if you go and look at galactic merger scales, it's of the order of hundreds of kiloparsecs or hundreds of parsecs, a few hundreds of parsec scales. The binary black hole scales for these supermassive black holes are of the few parsecs to astronomical units. Okay? So the black holes that were in each of the independent galaxies in the process of merging, separating by these type of scales, they go down to these scales just before merger. Okay? So I had to explain how you reach that regime in which at this point, at the point in which you have this type of scales, gravitational radiation is the one that takes over and shrinks the binary, and eventually the black holes merge. Now, that process, all the way from the beginning to the end, is likely to be strongly influenced by the environment. Okay? So that is something that we need to keep in mind.
So,
oh, you can, you know, giga years or something like that. So you're talking about when it reaches to this point?
You know, from compared to like the regular binary problem of, you know, a few 10 to 100 solar masses for the N-spirals here. Is it similar?
Yeah, I mean, in the absence of the matter, the timescales are the same if you use just units of M, okay? So all the scales in your problem, okay, if you use just geometrical units in which the only scale is the mass of the black hole, you can translate the stellar mass time scales to the supermassive black hole just by changing the mass the mass scale in that. And
so
just to give you an idea. I'm sorry?
You can just scale up the problem.
Absolutely. Without matter, you can scale it, all the results. You don't have to redo the results. So you can go scales of solar masses, what are microseconds? You know, that's what roughly M is, okay? To the scales of black holes in which the M, you know, if you had 10 to the 6 or something like that, it would be a few seconds or even more. Okay? But that's just at the end. Of course, if you're talking about these scales, it's much longer. All right. So what I'm going to walk you through, and it will basically be based on the work by Kolpe and the mayor was the one, and Dotti, who did these simulations. I'm going to walk you through the history of a binary in a gas-rich environment, okay? And so the first stage, which is the one depicted in this type of, the first part there, and actually, sorry that the thing is too difficult to read, even difficult here, because now I had to wear these things. So, okay, so the first slide is all the way to half of a giga year, okay? And when you get to this point here, at the bottom is about 2 from the beginning, okay? All right. So what you have is, not surprising, that the galaxies, the nucleus of the galaxies has a potential well that is the one that drags the black hole when the galaxy moves. It's just that. And it's sitting there. The black hole, if the galaxy moves, it drags with it the black hole, okay? So that is what happens here. Okay, so wherever the galaxy goes, the black hole goes with it. Okay, so now let's say that you're talking about a black hole of a million solar masses. Okay, so in that case, if we were to zoom in here, what you will see is that there is a disk, a stellar and gaseous disk, with a mass about 100 times more than the mass of that black hole. Okay, now the disk merge. Okay, when the galaxies merge. That's the first thing. I mean, it's not that the black holes drag the disk. No, no, no. This two things, because there is gas dynamical friction, so you form another nucleus. From the two that you had, you form one of them. And you will see, I have a more, that is what you see here, okay, but I have another slide that it shows that clear. So now, the two black holes, that they were, each of them fall on the well of the each of nuclei of the galaxy, now they go and sink into this common potential well. Okay, so that is at about this time here, okay? About this time there. And now you have reached from scales here, okay, that we're talking about I didn't put the scales here, but I mean, there are scales of kiloparsecs and so, okay, or more. Now you're getting to the point in which you have to bring it to scales of a few parsecs. And the process there is that dynamical friction with the gas, okay, in this now common nucleus, starts shrinking the binary. They're still not bound with each other. They're just shrinking the binary. And eventually, when the mass enclosed in a volume, the size of the separation of the binary is smaller. Okay? It's less than the binary mass. At that point, the black holes are bound into a binary, okay? A Keplerian type of binary. And that occurs around here, okay? And this is a plot from that simulation of the separation of the binary as a function of time. So here is the scale that I was mentioning. But only in this small window that is, you know, a fraction of a giga year or so, even less, a tenth of a giga year or less, which is where this panel is, okay? And you can see that there are some passages, but then at this point it starts to settling down into a binary that is bound in the Keplerian sense that we're familiar with. But it's still, the scales are huge. I mean, 10 parsecs is still way beyond what we can do with numerical relativity. This is the place where the simulations stop, about few parsecs here. They cannot resolve anymore. And actually, these simulations, I mean, are done by, you start with a large box, you do all your calculation, you stop, zoom in the region where you want, dispose everything else, and refine whatever that, and keep going. At some point, you reach a level of in which you cannot proceed, okay?
So this kind of plot is qualitatively similar for different systems, or this is for a particular example?
Here's a difference that I'm going to discuss. But in general terms, that's what is expected, although there are some concerns about how these simulations were done, but that's what is expected, hopefully. So now you want to go to...
In the figures that you were showing, it looked like the things that were colliding were coplanar?
It's the way that is being projected. Okay. And I don't know, in top of my head, that if these were disk galaxies in which the orientation of the disk were not with the orbital plane of that, but I think that's this part here is mostly projection on the orbital plane. But I don't know to which extent there is ejection
of
the
disk. But that doesn't really affect.
Right. Right. Okay. So now, how did you go beyond this? And one line of thought, which is very reasonable, is that three-body interactions with the surrounding stars will contribute. Okay. You have that. The star that comes together to the binary interacts and extracts angular momentum, and it hardens the binary. So the stars get ejected. At some point, unfortunately, you're going to run out of stars. The reservoir of stars that you have is going to be depleted, okay? And it will stall. Now, to show you the differences of the two, that this is not the primary driving mechanism, the same group did the following. Okay, here is a binary with mass ratio 1 to 4. Okay, they did two simulations, one of them in which the simulation was completely dry. What I mean by dry, there was only collisionless particles mimicking the presence of the star. The other one is they added 10% of gas to the environment. And you can see that the solid line at the beginning matches the dry one, which is the thin one. But you can see that at the end, okay, this is time, okay, at the end when you start getting closer and closer, the solid line reaches a smaller separation than the one that is drag. And that's because you run out of stars. Now, this thing here is difficult to believe that they have the resolution that to model all this star environment that is around, that indeed it will stall this thing. So if you don't resolve those scales, it's very likely that you will also be affected by resolution effect. So here's another case in which is now 30%, and look the noticeable difference in which you quit gas. If you keep having gas in the vicinity of the black holes, that gas, the friction with that gas will harden the binary. All right, and then what happens after that? Well, there is this gap that is known as the last parsec problem. Well, why the last parsec? Because if you take a black hole around 10 to the 6 or so, there is a gap of about a parsec of a separation, roughly, okay? No, actually, it's for 10 to the 7. Here is the parsec, in which anything that you do with gas and with stars, to what we understand right now, is thought that it will not be efficient to shrink the orbit. So it will stay there. That separation is just too large for gravitational radiation to shrink the orbit in a whole time or whatever, you know, that we can observe. So there was that problem in which gravitational radiation is this blue thing here. Anything that falls into this separation here, it will shrink by gravitational radiation in a time scale that is reasonable to explain what we observe. Anything in this gap will not. Okay? So then there was this problem. Now, there were many ways around, but I think the one that recently has been favored is the one studied numerically by Quadra and collaborators, that it says that there is a disk around the binary in which, once again, the torques and the interaction of the binary with the disk is able to shrink the orbit. And it has some similarities to what happens, for instance, with the moons in Saturn, okay? That, you know, you have this, the rings, you have, you know, dust and granular material, and the way that these moons migrate and all that is with interaction with the disk. And the same thing happens in planet formation. So some of the ideas were borrowed from that. And it's not surprising, then, that the most effective way to shrink the orbit is if you have unequal mass binaries, as it happens in the solar system, that you have the sun dominated the total mass of it. And here is what one of the main findings by this group is, that here is now all the plots that I had before. They plot separation here and then time here. This is the opposite. I don't know why they did it. But anyway, here is the separation. So it's this axis here. And this is the time that it takes to shrink the orbit. Okay? And this dashed line here is if you only use three-body encounters. So it's consistent. The smaller the separation, the longer it will take, because you are depleting the system from the stars in your reservoir. So that's why at some point it's not effective to shrink the orbit. It's just the time scales are too large. So what Quadra found is that with this disk, at large separations, the disk is not very effective, so the time scales are very long. But then as the binary shrinks, okay, eventually when you reach a transition from optically thin to optically thick in the disk, okay, what you're going to see is that now the scales are much shorter. That is, what operates here to extract angular momentum is more effective, because the disk is able to transport that when it's optically thick. So this is one way, although there is a paper by Pringle and others recent that they show that perhaps this is not as effective as it was claimed to shrink the orbit.
What makes the disk transition from thin to thick?
I'm sorry?
What makes transition of the disk from thin to thick? Or you're
imagining? It's just the density. Thick? It's just the density. The density drops as you go up.
Oh, okay. So you're putting back. By hand, just imagine.
Yeah, it's assumed that as you get closer to the inner parts, the disk will be denser, and then that's it. So I just, yeah, okay. There was a, no, all right.
Yeah, so, but just because, so the only interaction between black holes and disk is gravitation. The idea is there's no actual coupling of the direct couple.
Well, there is still a little bit of friction, but it mostly, there are torques. I mean, the gas here is the one that has, I mean, you have to get rid of the angular momentum somehow. It's the disk that transports that out. So there is an interaction between the black holes and the disk. But yes, that's gravitational. Okay. All right. Okay, and finally, when you reach these scales, so imagine that. Now we're going to 10 to the minus 3 parsecs, okay? That's when gravitational radiation takes over. This is just a profile of one of our simulations. And at that point, this object, this system, becomes one of the most luminous sources of gravitational radiation, or any type. This is the types of luminosity that we have. But then the interesting thing there is, as opposed to the solar mass black holes that we expect practically no matter around for practical purposes, in this case, if there is matter around left in the vicinity of the binary, as this snapshot shows, we expect to have electromagnetic signals, and that is the main objective of the work that I'm going to be showing for the rest of this talk. So this is an opportunity to do what we call multi-messenger astronomy, in which joint observations, gravitational and electromagnetic, will give us a more complete picture of what's going on. All right, so why is it that we're interested in this? Well, if we had this type of observations, combined observations, electromagnetic and gravitation, they don't have to be simultaneous, but I mean, you know, the information from both. By simultaneous, that doesn't mean that you have LIGO or LISA and whatever telescope detecting at the same time. You can just detect it first electromagnetically and then go back in the data stream of LISA and find it there. But as long as you have information from both, you can improve the sky localization of where the sources are. The detection rates, you can tell us if, for instance, you have some of them, they are luminous in electromagnetic spectrum, but they don't have other ones that they are not, but you see the signals from both gravitational, you can tell you something about the rates. The Scott Hughes and collaborators use this to define what is called cosmological standard sirens, that it will help us understand, among other things, for instance, distance scales and so forth. It will tell us also important physics, accretion physics around black holes. And as usual, you can see any work that we do in gravity, you will see this bullet, a test of GI. I'm not surprised. Okay.
So how many such events are expected to be detected by LISA per year?
Of this kind?
Yeah.
I mean, let's say electromagnetically, we don't know. But I mean, gravitationally, if I remember correctly, the last number for supermassive black holes, there were a few, no more than 10, more than 3, if I remember correctly, a year. The supermassive ones.
But these are without their electromagnetic counterparts, or with?
No. We don't know yet for electromagnetic. But I mean, just the pure supermassive black hole binaries, if I remember, there could be one per month. The fewest that that I've seen quarter is 3 or so per year.
I can remember. I thought the number was much larger than that.
I think the larger one was for gravitational radiation from the ones in the noise, the white dwarf binaries and so forth. But if I remember, but anyway, I'll check on that. But I remember that there was of the order of one per month or something like that.
Right. Okay. Well, it depends on the models that people have for. Supermassive binary
black hole, right,
galaxy
right.
mergers. Right? But, and then the numbers go from a few to several dozens.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It all depends on Mark Vaughan.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, we can. Okay, so now, modeling matter in the vicinity of black hole mergers. Okay, so now hopefully I convince you that, you know, it's not a useless exercise to apply all the numerical relativity machinery to do mergers of black holes with matter around, okay? So the goal then there is to look for astrophysically relevant configurations, okay? And, you can try to add gas, electromagnetic fields, but the bottom line, okay, what I want to emphasize here, that for any astrophysically relevant situation, the black holes do not know, so to speak, about the presence of these other fields. Okay? That is, the dynamics of the black holes is not affected at all for detection purposes, is not affected at all by the presence of gas or magnetic fields. So by that, I want to emphasize the following. I can do a numerical relativity simulation of two black holes merging in vacuum, okay, then save the entire space-time of that simulation, then run again on top of it, now with that information that you have, a hydrodynamic simulation or an electromagnetic or Maxwell-type simulation or an MHC simulation on top of it, and the result will be the same as doing the full problem. Okay? By that I mean is there is no back reaction on the black holes in the proper sense that we understand in GR. Okay, and I'm going to go into that in a second. For that reason, the first piece of work in that sense, this first step was taken by the group in Goddard, in which they did test particles. Okay, they put the two black holes, there are two black dots here, surrounded by a shell of test particles. They did the black hole simulation. They followed the geodesics. And they had a trick that if two geodesics come too close together, they call that a collision. They remove one and keep with the other one, you know, something like that. And to be able to mimic proper dynamics of gas or so forth, or make statements along those lines. They put 25,000 particles in some different distributions. They look at the maximum Lorentz factor of these particles, and they found, not surprising, that when you're about to merge the black hole, here is about the merger time, you get an increase in the Lorentz factor of that. Of course, I mean, you get the black holes are spinning quite rapidly, and there is a way to eject these things through the geodesic. So, but it's a good indication that if you're going to do the full problem, to pay attention if there is a flare there, and I'll come back into that. Now, the second was done, and Luis was involved in this thing, is to put electromagnetic fields. So here you remove the hydro and solve Maxwell equations on top of Einstein. They did it couple. There is no approximation, but at the end, again, just to emphasize the point, if you calculate the ratio of electromagnetic radiation to that of gravitational, there is this difference here. So it's, we are dominated, okay? We are dominated, in this case, by gravitational emission. If you go to magnetic fields that are reasonable, okay? Now, why is it there? Because 10 to the 4 is roughly when you reach equipartition, when you have hydronate and other processes. So that's why this number is the one to keep in mind. And the frequencies are a little too low. Now, it's a little disappointing that, because it would be very nice to have astrophysical signals coming from this system, it's a little disappointing, but not quite. I mean, they conclude that even in the absence of direct observations, there could be that this type of thing affects the accretion rates, and you can indirectly measure that. So it's not, I mean, I want to emphasize that it's an important result. You can, in principle, hopefully detect this. Yes?
Why is it that you expect the magnetic field to be equipartition with the hydrodynamic energy rather than...
No, you don't expect that, but that is the upper bound that you expect, hopefully. I mean, it would be less.
Even though there's this much, much bigger energy source around.
Okay, so I thought that you were arguing that 10 to the 4 is too large. I mean, typically people use less than equipartition, but not above that. Okay, so
there's no way to detect.
Yeah. So, I mean, reasonable things, I mean, you will see, in a special result that I'll discuss of Shapiro, you will see that he has 10 to the 3 Gauss. Okay, we actually go to 1 Gauss. The answer is that we just don't know what happens there. But it will be very difficult to explain going beyond that. I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe you're going after, well, there is this extra source of energy that you could use to pump the fields. But
right.
This work that didn't allow for that yet, because that one was Maxwell with no currents.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to put the currents in, maybe things would change.
So some sort of a dynamo effect to amplify the fields? Okay. All right, yeah, that's good. All right, so the next step, so we have test particles, Maxwell fields, and now the next step that we took is to put a gas there. No electromagnetic fields, a gas. We did this, and then a few weeks or a month later, the group in Illinois, Stu Shapiro, came up with something that has a strong overlap, although the regime's a little bit different, which was good and bad. It was good because then you have another case to draw astrophysical conclusions. It was bad because we could not do a direct comparison. But, I mean, you know, that's, you know, we didn't know that we were doing, they didn't know we were going. Okay, so I'm going to talk mostly about this, but I also mentioned something about that. So, and again, the main emphasis here is that we don't know what the environment in the vicinity of binary black holes is when they are separated just in the last few orbits, you know, 10, 20 orbits before merger. So what we did is we bracketed the situation into two extremes. One in which you have a hot gas supported by pressure, that could be one. And the other one in which you have a disk, which is a cold gas. So it's expected that maybe the truth will be somewhere in between, or linear superposition of the two or whatever. I suspect that it will not be neither case. In terms of simplicity, it will be something more complicated, but anyway. And so what we did, we put our two black holes. separated by a distance of AM in parsec CCs. Remember, gravitational radiation takes over at the post-Newtonian level at 10 to the minus 3 parsecs, roughly. So we're very deep inside the post-Newtonian regime, actually already at the point at which it fails. So we're in the GR regime of gravitational radiation. We have a, just we pick, for this thing, we pick a scale. Going back to your question, in this case, you cannot apply one to another one because then the matter scales differently dependent on the mass, so you cannot translate. If I go to a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole, the density is going to go up, and maybe it will be unrealistic, okay? So that's why the scaling is, now that you have other scales present because of the gas, you cannot just do one run and rescale it. The temperature of the electrons in this is about 10 to the 10. We picked a Gaussian profile just for simplicity, okay? The thing is that the first test runs that we were doing, I asked my people, why don't you just go and do this for simplicity? Turns out that these simulations are very expensive. The irony of the whole thing is that 5 years ago I said the most difficult problem is solving Einstein equations in a computer. Well, right now, a simulation like this with hydro, okay, spends 75% of the time doing hydro, okay, and only 25% solving the Einstein equations, believe it or not. So once that we realized that everything was working, it was too late for us to change the setup to redo all the runs, but we are doing it now. But we want to just, this is like a prototype type of problem to see how. Now the boundary is sufficiently far out that it doesn't affect what's going in inside, but it's likely that the type of matter that feeds and accretes into the black hole is not going to be as realistic as one would expect when you have all these other gas coming and accreted into the black hole. Okay.
How do you set the temperature? So this is just by the velocity profile of fluid, or you have a temperature component in your equation state?
The equation state is a gamma law, okay. But we start with a polytrop and we pick the adiabatic constant to have that temperature. Now, but that's a good question. So how do we pick these two here? Okay, we grab the information from the Kolpe results of the, in which they say that at the end of their simulation, they have in a volume of 10 to the minus 2 parsecs, they have 1% of the mass of the binary in the gas, and that's how we calculated the density. And then the temperature, we did the same thing. We extrapolated it. So this thing here, you just have to take it as order of magnitude and that. Yeah, this is just let me just skip that one. That if you want, you can. And we did these cases, four cases, in which we have zero spins, two spins pointing up along the orbital angular momentum with this magnitude, two the same but increase the magnitude, and then the other one in which we point it down. Okay, so four cases. So if we were doing just vacuum GR, you can see now there are papers in which they have, you know, 100 simulations and so forth, because it's a lot cheaper to do that. What I have here on the left is, both of them is the gas density. Here you have the two black holes, okay? And this case is the 0.6, aligned along the angular momentum, and this is the one that is anti-aligned. You will see that it's going to loop over. You're going to see that the differences are very tricky to detect, but they are there, okay? And and I'll talk about initial conditions in a second. The other thing is that since the total spin from the black hole is zero here, these guys merge faster. There is not as much angular momentum that you had to radiate. This will take a little bit longer. It's the so-called hang-up effect, okay? But you can see that it's not completely symmetric. It's going to go again. But here you can see perfectly the symmetry in the two, you know, accretion profiles and so forth. The other thing to point out is that our cloud is not rotating. It's just static cloud, so the gas doesn't know about the presence of the black hole. We freeze the black hole for a while and let the gas know the presence of the black holes, but it doesn't know that the black holes are rotating. So the first orbit, anything that you see in the first orbit, we discard, because we don't believe that there is any information there. It's all tied to our initial configuration. We need to let the system flush that type of memory from the initial data, so to speak. And the other thing that I want that you focus your attention is that the regions of higher density, you will see that they are correlated to the place where you have the largest luminosity coming. The other thing that I'm going to come back is the presence of this bar here that you also see in simulations of galaxy mergers. That is not surprising. You have that as the two potential wells come closer, you form kind of a potential channel in between. So mass falls into that area. And the higher the density, the higher the temperature, the larger the luminosity.
If you increase the spin, do you expect some of the matter to fall outside the...
That's to some extent that... it's not clear here, but I mean, this is a 0.4. If you keep staring at these movies that as I have been doing, I mean, first of all, you see a little tighter here, this kind of spiral arm that is in this case. But and then you will see that this front goes a little forward more. But yes, as you increase the spin, that's what is it. Now, this is a favorable situation in which the spins are pointing out of the screen. I suppose, like we're doing currently, that if you have spins with arbitrary orientation, you will see more interesting, steering effects of the... Yeah?
Is mass being fed in from the outside of the box?
No.
So these kind of arms, is matter flowing in along those arms or out?
Some of it is out and some of it is in.
Are the thin arms flowing out?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, remember, this is the scale is -5 to +5. And our computational domain is 300. So we're just zooming in the inner part.
Well, given that you have stared at these movies a lot, so maybe you can say that I'm wrong, but if I looked at carefully around the region of the black holes, it would look like it's, or is it a color scale not being the same? Because it looks like it's brighter around the black holes on the right than on black holes on the left.
And it for that one, yes.
But don't you expect the opposite? They have higher spins, so the orbit that is... gas is getting to is a lot tighter to the black hole.
You're talking about this to that.
Yeah.
No, that's the scale.
Oh, okay, they got to the...
Yeah. They normalized to the... No, in this thing here, one black hole is brighter than the other one because they have the spins in different directions. Mm-hmm. And that does matter, and you will see that when I talk about the accretion. Okay? So, it's likely that there are shocks. Okay, these things move about 30% the speed of light or more, the black holes in those orbits. So it's likely, so we plot the Mach number that is above 1, that is where you will expect to see shocks, and not surprising is in these fronts that you will see some, and in areas in which near the black hole as well. Now, we have also plots of which material is flying out and which one is accreting, but I don't have them here, but it's mostly out, okay? The one that is in is in this region, but the other one, it just pushes things out, okay? Now, the luminosity, okay, so remember, these simulations, we don't have radiator transfer or anything like that, so it's only a pure hydro simulation, so what we have is we evolve density, velocity, and internal energy, specific internal energy, okay? So from there, you have to go and jump and say, make an educated guess of which radiative processes are operating to calculate the luminosity. It could be synchrotron, inverse quantum, or branch traveling, or things like that. So what we did is we make a rough estimate of this time scales that are operating there. We make a guess about the type of magnetic fields we think that they are there. And we concluded that given the densities that we have, given the temperatures that we have, we concluded that we are dominated by branch travel. But that is... you can equally argue, if you are like Shapiro did, that the magnetic fields are 10 to the 3, and then you get something in which, for that case actually, and also the density, he was dominated by synchrotron as opposed to brain shroud. I don't think people should get too fixated about those two, the difference. We can convert one and the other one with the same data. That's the whole point. It's just the assumptions that you make in setting up magnetic fields or in setting up levels of density. There.
But,
yeah?
is in the material. Didn't you say that you had an optically thick vision? I mean, what do you expect to have black body be embedded on the frame struggle?
No. That was the disk that Quadra had. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Once that it gets to very close, it's expected that it will be optically thin everywhere except very close to the horizon of the black holes. So this act like, and that's what we detected, that it will be optically thin out, and it's only near these hot spots that it's optically thick.
How near is near?
I mean, near is, it's a few m. I mean, I'm talking about 2 m or even less than that. I mean, remember here the horizons are at a half because it's isotropic type coordinates. Okay. Here is then once we say okay, this emission from Bremsstrahlung is the same too, but now looking at the emissivity. Okay. So those are the hot spots, and they're concentrated. This is where it's optically thick. And then there is going to be a bar that becomes optically thick because the density increases there. The rest is optically thin. All right?
So how are the spins aligned in the second?
The second one, up and down. Why? Because then we can impose symmetries to cut the computational cost. Okay? It's just, remember, this is expensive. Okay. Now, just so you can just see the two together, how the places where the matches, I mean, the places where the shocks are expected with the Bremsstrahlung emission, and you can see a not surprising a correlation. Let me just keep going. Okay. Here is then what we do. Once that we have the emissivity, we integrate that, and we compute the luminosity. And we did it two ways. One of them, we ignore Doppler beaming. And it's this red curve. And what we see is that the luminosity goes down, and then right before the merger here, okay, it goes up and you get that flare that I show in the thing. And then the signal shuts off, there is something remaining there, and then the signal again shuts off and on. Now, there are several things here. First of all, the reason that the luminosity decays is because, as Luis asked, we have a cloud that the density goes down. So the two black holes start accreting, and at some point they start going to run it out of material. Okay? That's perhaps not what is going to happen. Shapiro did the opposite. They put a Bondi Hoyle type of accretion, so he kept feeding material from the outside. I'm going to show you a curve of their results, and you will see that the luminosity stays put, and it actually just increases. Is that this part here, this decay, is an artifact that we are not feeding more material that some people believe that should be the case. Okay, so that's that. Now this here, this increase here, is purely through the merger. We both get them. Like we, the Shapiro group and us, we get it. And that is a result that as the merger closes, you get that there is the density increases in those neighborhood, and eventually you get this flare. Okay, this signal here in our case. Okay. Since the material is going down, suppose that you just had a single black hole accreted, not surprising, this thing will continue this way. Okay? So this is an indication of the binary here. And what happens is that the signal shows up because the bar, this bar, let me just run the movie so you can see both similar what is happening. So this first orbit is not here. Okay? This happens this way, and we just ignore it. Then at some point, you get this, that is the luminosity is decreasing. The numbers you can see that they're going down is a very difficult thing. Now, right now, most of the luminosity is dominated by this bar, but the bar shrinks and disappears. At the moment of disappearance, that's what this comes down. And then you have just the normal accretion into a single black hole. But this structure here is the leftover remnants that the black holes had steer this gas, and it's all this structure there. That is what happened. And then you get back to the background solution that I'll come back next. Okay. Now, these oscillations here is when we put the Doppler beaming. That means that we put the effect that these guys here, if you have an observer in the equatorial plane, you have that one block, one part of this body is moving towards you and the other one is moving away from you. So that's why you get these oscillations here. Okay? These oscillations is as if you had, suppose that you have this hockey stick rotating this way and this way emitting light, you will see Doppler shift due to that. Okay? All right. Almost done. So for the four runs that we have, these are the four profiles that we have in luminosity. So all, with exception of the one that is the interesting one with high spins, the material that we, and that is goes back to your question, the higher the spin, you're going to have more material that it gets affected by the presence of the black hole. So there is leftover junk, you know, all inhomogeneous that it needs to be absorbed, and then you go back to this solution here that is, you know, is an exponential type solution, the key, then I'll come back here. In a second. Yes?
Is the bulk of the luminosity coming from regions where the gravitational redshift is pretty weak?
No, actually, it's pretty high. We haven't taken that into account. Shapiro did. Shapiro did an integration, a proper integration to take into account the redshift from being emitted at 2 or 3 m back to the observer. Mm-hmm. Okay,
that's where the bulk of the luminosity is coming from, that close to
the... Yeah.
But can we go back to the bridge transverse? Because yeah. I was buying the spin argument that had really stirred the material around quite a bit to explain that hump. But then if I go to the zero spin case, as you said, the big fat bullies are the black holes going around.
Yeah.
Whether they have spin or not, I don't care. And so why don't you see the hump? In the G0 case?
In this G0 case?
Yeah, in the G1 case. I would expect, as these black holes are going around, they're messing up all this material that's around, so you're going to have things around that have structure that they would have some extra energy that would be being radiated. So, that the arguments that you have for the humps in G2 and G3 would be applicable also in G0 and G1.
I don't have the side-by-side of this case or this case with this, but I have it in two different slides, but it is here. I mean, this one here, okay, if you look at merger, if there is any mass left, I think this is the 0.0 or the 0.4, you will see that immediately goes into very radial type of bonding hole accretion. And then I'll go back. The first slide that I showed was a 0.6, that is something left out. You see that there is thing going, but you see how symmetric it is, and then it immediately goes into that. So this thing here, this spiral pattern, it was already present there even just before merger. Okay? Now, if you go back to this case, so pay attention to this thing here, you will not get the clean spiral at the moment of merger. You still see a little bit left. Let me see. There you go.
Why does it flash?
Oh, that is the
the color map is changed.
Yeah, the color map.
Those are signals.
Yeah. But you see, already there is kind of fragmentation type of this thing here. There is also a little more mess. And it's not this clean spiral just at merger. So there is, just for a period of few m, you still have a little bit of mess left over. You see? It was not as clean as the... And now... You need to remember that, okay, there you go. You still have, a little bit, sorry, I didn't. And you know why? Because this case has more angular momentum because of the spins. It takes many more orbits before merger. And here the key point is how many orbits you have around at close separation steering the gas around. The 0.0 doesn't have as much angular momentum as this, and the same thing for this. So it just basically plunges faster, doesn't spend time at a given separation to steer the gas around. Okay.
Well,
of course, an alternative explanation is, okay, you also have to run longer, therefore boundary effects begin to play around.
This boundary is, yeah, no, that, yeah, you can think of it, but if you believe it, it's more, the key point here is how, if you can manage to make them spend more time at close separation with whatever gas you have around. We have changed the recipe for the gas, but you're so deep in the potential that the gas outside basically sees practically one black hole, the gas far away. Okay, so you can feed it the way we did, the way Shapiro did, but because the spins are so large, it had to wander around more times, and it has time to steer what is in this bucket. Okay? All right. Almost done here. Okay, so this is just to show that, yes, we have flares, okay? But it's very naive to think that if, because you see one is an indication of a merger. Here is this case in which we have, you know, all sorts of things. So I think it's dangerous to conclude that this thing here maps with just the present. You can trigger those, that type of increase of Lorentz factors with other, by other means. In this case, it was having, this case, large spins. Okay? This is the accretion. Somebody asked about the accretion. So the accretions are of this order. For the case in which the spin are aligned, they are symmetric. It's not surprising that the accretion rate in one black hole is equal to the other one. So these are the two curves on top of the other one, and these are the sum of the two. If you have one spin up and one down, far away, the black holes act the same way. When you get very close to each other, then there's not only the separation, okay, it's a factor because they're spinning fast, but having one spin up and one down means that the accretion rate on one is different from the other one. The one with the spin pointing towards the screen has a lower rate. Now, this is a tricky calculation. We have the advantage that we know where the horizon is, so we can calculate what matter goes through the horizon.
Sorry, did you, so the retrograde black hole accretes more?
The retrograde accretes less because, you see, S1 points in the same direction as the angular orbital angular momentum. So that's what I will call prograde. Okay? The retrograde doesn't accrete as much. We had an argument for that, but I in top of my head, but I can come back to that. I just don't want to be too late.
No, don't worry about that.
No? No. Okay.
But actually, I agree with you. Because the retrograde, the East Coast would be further out, so it should be eating more.
But I guess
at this point, I don't think. What do you say the East Coast is?
So if the East Coast is a lot bigger, so it's kind of naively the retrograde black hole is a bigger cross section of heat matter.
The East Coast is a lot bigger.
Luminosity wise, I think if one were to see just from the point of view of luminosity, going prograde, we have a higher luminosity. Going retrograde, we have a higher m dot, just because. I mean, so for an extreme black hole, for a very highly spinning black hole, the East Coast goes to 1, to m. For the prograde, it goes to 9m for a retrograde. They have a black hole 10 times larger now.
I don't know if it's about, yeah. I will have to think about it, but the way that we thought about it is how much angular momentum a fluid element will have to lose to get in one case in which, suppose that the velocity at, for the one that is prograde, okay, the relative velocity, let's just put it the other way. If I go to a commoving frame with a black hole, which one has larger angular momentum relative to that one in one case as opposed to the other one. And that's how we thought that it was consistent with this measurement. Okay? The one counter-grade, it will have more angular momentum, right, relative to the center of the black hole, right? Anyway, let's come back to that. But I mean, we can. Anyway, so the point here that I want to make is that, first of all, this is one calculation in which it is crucial to use the dynamical horizon type of machinery. We identify the horizons. We calculate also there through that surface the accretion rate. Now the tricky thing that you could ask, why do I have this dip here? Okay. Well, the problem is that the black holes come together, okay, and at some point there is a horizon that appears outside. The volume is larger, okay. Then it's very tricky to decide when you have, in terms of this, when you have one black hole as opposed to two merging. So you have to start approaching the problem from the left and the right and just make an educated guess of where it is. So I will not trust these values here. I think what happens here is that you already have a horizon outside and it's just that we don't find it. So what I will say is that the truth is somewhere interpolated between these two here. The same thing here, okay?
How do you identify the trapping region for the horizon?
I'm sorry?
How do you identify the trapping region for the horizon?
Oh, we have this solver that finds the outermost trapped region. And that is, you know, every group has their own. I mean, we use one that was developed by Jonathan Thornburg. But and it's a well-established machinery. Okay. The single test, so we put a single black hole in the same cloud, and the thick dash, the thin line is what you get. Okay, so that is your background solution. Anything above this, we have rescaled the time scale to have all the simulations match. So what we have here is the accretion rate. Okay, anything that you see above this is due to the binary. That's why we cut this part, okay, and that's why you saw those straight lines at the end of the luminosity of the accretion rate. Anything above that is due to the black hole. So, and Shapiro does the same thing, to be able to single out what things are just the due to a one black hole for those that affect due to the... We did a correlation between the simulation, the luminosity and the gravitational waves. Not surprising, the oscillations and on the luminosity are correlated with oscillations and the gravitational wave because it's, you know, it's just orbital effect. Okay? Then just my last slide before conclusions. Shapiro, what they did is the environment that they used, it was this Bondi Hoyle type of accretion that they keep feeding mass. So here is the accretion rate. It doesn't go down because they keep feeding material. These dots are just correlated to some snapshots in their paper. But they have this thing, you know, there is an increase and then they reach the solution of a single black hole. And here is the luminosity again. Instead of going down like ours did, stays roughly flat, and then you get the flare, and then it shuts off, and then it continues that. So the point here is that that type of trend is strongly dependent on how you feed material, but the bottom line, which shouldn't be very surprising, is that you have something dramatic happen at the moment of merger. Okay? Okay, conclusions. All right? So our study shows in terms of the luminosity and all that, that when you immerse a binary black hole in a hot turbulent gas, it has similar properties to that of low luminosity AGNs. We have been able to correlate some variability in the electromagnetic signal to that in the gravitational waves. This thing here, please don't make too much out of it because that variability is strongly dependent on the orientation. So it could happen that if you have spins of the orientation of the mind is different, that it completely washes out that. It also depends that we're assuming that the environment is optically thin or optically thick in the immediate vicinity of the black hole. If it's optically thin in a larger region, it will also erase that. Okay? We have made estimates that the most massive black holes that LISA will observe, that is the 10 to the 7 solar mass black holes, could be visible electromagnetically up to a redshift of 1 based on our results. And these are just prototype simulations. We're currently doing more work to get into configurations that hopefully are more astrophysically plausible. And the next step, you know, we had to put cooling, we need to do examples with circumbinary disk, and maybe magnetic fields, as Luis is working on, plays also a role in this, and that's the future direction that we're going. Thank you.
comparison to your last slide, the previous slide. So I'm sorry, like I missed some point. That what is the key difference in your assumptions and this work?
We went, put a cloud, a binary, and the cloud has this profile that exponentially the density goes to almost zero. Okay?
In your case.
In my case. So that as the evolution proceeds, even with a single black hole, as you keep evolving, the black hole is going to start accreting all the material, but since the density drops, okay, you never reach a steady state case. Okay? What Shapiro did is he keep feeding material at the rate that the black hole is able to accrete. So at some point, that's why his curves at the end are flat. Okay? So he managed to feed the material, because it's an analytic solution, when you have a single black hole, at the rate that the black hole can absorb. And the only difference then is that generated by what happens with the black holes when they're in the process of merger. The same thing happens with the luminosity. Our luminosity goes down because luminosity is proportional to the density squared. Once that our black holes are eating all that stuff that they can, then it will go down. Now, what we're doing, because we believe that either case, we're doing things in which we feed things in homogeneous blocks, we change the rates and so forth to be able to see if there are bulk features associated with the binary that do not depend on the initial condition. I believe that this, given these two examples of one in which the density goes down abruptly because it's here, and this, there are features like this that are robust in the sense that are associated with that. And it's not, to me, now that we see things after we did it, it's not surprising. That is the most dramatic part of the gravitational in terms of potential wells, okay, that you can imagine. So I think it will be very difficult to change how to feed that potential well unless you go to some extremes, okay?
And both of you get a similar correlation in the variability of the electromagnetic signal in the gravitational wave, or there is a difference in the strength of correlation?
I see your point. Yeah. We haven't done that. The only correlation that we have done is in the periodicity, but that one is kind of obvious. But I see what you're saying. If there is a correlation between the amplitude of this flare with the gravitational radiation in this case and in our case, and maybe the ratio will stay the same or something, I don't know. But that's that will require some comparison with them. Okay.
In one of your earlier plots, you mentioned that for a very large spin, so spins of 0.6, I think, if you don't get a clear flare signal at merger, you can get something that might mimic a flare signal earlier.
Okay, let me see.
What you don't get a clear, can you say something about?
Yeah, I know. Okay. This one here. Okay, so what I'm saying is that, you see, they see a flare here. Let's see, in this case here. Okay, this is a non-rotating cloud. It will be the one that is close to us. They see this increase of from a background of 2 to 4 or something like that, okay? So what we're saying is that if you start thinking that this is the same as triggered by the same type of effect that in their simulations, you will be wrong, because this thing happens. I mean, this happens before the merger. So what I'm saying is that just basing your conclusions on the dynamics of test particles, you get a good insight, but it's not the final answer in this case. There are other things that could trigger. I mean, it could happen that the spins also trigger these large accelerations of the particles or accelerate the particles to large boost velocities and boosts that... I suspect that this is happening on that. Okay.
Any question? Okay.
All right.
Person, this is Peter Zimmerman.
Hi.
Chuck Garrett.
Oh, hi.